Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 77. Maxwellian Ratchets with Alex Jurgens. Alex is a postdoctoral researcher at INRIA, the French Institute for Research in Digital Science and Technology. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/77. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, related episodes of Physics Frontiers, and other things I might decide to add along the way. And now, Alex Jurgens. Hey, Alex, how's it going?
Hi, Jim. Nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you.
I wanted to talk to you about this 2020 paper, I think, Functional Thermodynamics of Maxwellian Ratchets. I thought this was very interesting. I thought there were a couple of interesting things about it. So I really enjoyed how you're looking at how, a computing device, I'll just call it a computing device, how it has different regions in which it's doing different things with the entropy. That was the first thing that I saw in this. And then upon the second reading, I'm sitting there and I missed all this stuff about the fractal dimension part. So, I mean, it was there, but I just missed it on the first reading, and on the second reading, it's just getting even better, right? So I'd really like to get into that and talk to you a little bit about how all of this is working and what it actually means, which by one of your emails, it looks like I missed the big meaning in all the details. So I'm sorry about that.
To be fair, this paper, I mean, honestly, it's kind of two papers in one. And that goes back to, I'm sure you're familiar with the paper process. And sometimes, you know, you get back from the editors and they're like, we need more of this, more of that. So we ended up with sort of two parts, and the paper kind of reads as a two-parter. So it's not surprising that, you know, you read it once and then you read it a second time, and you get a different meaning. The first part is that, like, if you look at the subtitle, it's Functional Thermodynamics of Maxwellian Ratchets. So the first part is that constructing and deconstructing patterns. And you said entropy, so that has to do with both thermodynamic entropy, but also the Shannon information entropy of these tapes that we're processing. So we can wrap back around to what I'm referring to when I say tapes. And then that secondary part, the randomizing and de-randomizing behaviors, that's referring to this like fractal memory structure. And we can talk about where that comes from as well. So those are actually two different ways of thinking about how some abstract information reservoir might be characterized in terms of the informational content. It can either be kind of random or not random, which is characterized by Shannon entropy, or it can be memoryful or not memoryful, which is characterized by this structural component we call statistical complexity, which is related to its fractal dimension. So yeah, two different orthogonal concepts.
Very good. So I think one thing people might not be familiar with is the fact that there are different entropies, right? Mm-hmm. That there's a information entropy, the Shannon entropy, and there's the thermodynamic entropy. I don't know if anybody, do they call it like the Gibbs entropy or?
Yeah, you can say Gibbs entropy. You know, usually in the context of something like this, oftentimes actually, because these sorts of papers, I mean, mine is sort of not in the real weeds of the stochastic thermo literature, but a lot of times because you're working away from equilibrium, where we usually think about like Gibbs entropy being defined, right? You have some weird thermodynamic concept, you might just talk about the specific energetics rather than calling it energy. I won't get into all of that, but if you look, I think it's equation one in the paper, references this sort of energetics with comparison to a probability. So some probability of something happening ratio with probability of its reverse happening is related to the energetic consequence of that trajectory. And then that winds up being related to entropy. And you can show that being related to a thermodynamic entropy. I think that was a little confusing. Do you want me to go like through what like Gibbs entropy is versus Shannon entropy? I think that might be a better...
Well, I think we got a pretty good idea there, right? Okay. I mean, the Gibbs entropy is your classic statistical thermodynamics or classic statistical mechanics entropy, the one you learn in junior year of college. Yeah. And that is technically only defined in equilibrium, which for a lot of things is a problem. I mean, maybe it's not a complete problem, but you know, people have done a lot of things, you know, with quasi pseudo semi equilibrium stuff to try to, you're in the quasi equilibrium
right.
regime, and you can still use something kind of similar and say we've got some sort of rate or something like that, some sort of production. It's not really equilibrium, but it's not too far off, right? And then we have the information entropy, which is, you know, I think in, you know, it's all about, one, it's all about probabilities. And mm-hmm. in my understanding, which is never really completely clear, it's generally a part of that total thermodynamic entropy when people have described it. But do you think they're completely separate, or how do you think they really relate?
So I think of them as separate ideas mathematically. So the hint, I guess, that they were related originally came from this mathematical correspondence. So in 1941, when Shannon published the mathematical theory of communication and introduced the idea of information entropy, what he was really exploring was, you know, he worked for Bell Labs, right? The telecommunications laboratory. And this was right after World War II, right? So during World War II, you know, you have Bletchley Park, you have the Enigma machine, all of that, like Alan Turing stuff that was really in the pop culture a few years ago. People were really fascinated and of course, very motivated to study this question of messages and how do you decode them and how do you compress them? How do you transmit them? Telecommunications was taking off in the public sphere. So Shannon published this idea of this mathematical formulation of basically how much you can compress a message. So what he shows is that based on this codebook schema where you have some probability distribution over symbols, any given message can be compressed to some limit that has to do with how probable any given symbol is. And so he calls this information entropy. And that ends up actually being really about this kind of operational meaning of how noisy can my channel be and still I can understand what the other person is saying. And then, you know, Gibbs entropy is this like microstate, like, you know, what's the distribution over possible thermodynamic states that I have? And, you know, how far away is that from sort of this normal curve? But it turns out that this P log P function is the same in both cases. I mean, it's not an exact mathematical equivalency because with the Gibbs entropy, you have to have this KBT, like thermodynamic factor. Whereas with Shannon entropy, it's just in bits. It's this like abstract idea where the probabilities aren't really attached to any physical thing. It's just you assign something a probability. But what was then recognized is that in certain situations, you can actually relate these two ideas. And this is the case when, you know, some kind of information processing actually requires energetic consequence. Like Landauer talks about this with the Landauer's bound, which shows that because information requires some medium, it has to be embedded into something. Any kind of irreversible information change, like erasure, you know, you add X plus Y, you get a third number, you can't recover X and Y. That's an irreversible computation, requires a minimal energy expenditure. And so because that thermodynamic relationship, you do end up with a relationship between both the entropy produced by this energy expenditure and then also, you know, information entropy.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good explanation there. So let's see. Have I actually asked you yet what the problem is you're trying to solve?
No, we haven't. Okay. I've gone like over like 50 ideas, I think, already. Okay. But if I were going to introduce just this paper, you know, from the start, what I would say is there's this huge literature behind us that we've been poking at, right? We've been talking about, I threw out Shannon, I threw out Landauer, I threw out Gibbs. There's all these different names. But the main idea that people are interested in is that relationship, that information has some kind of energetic consequence. And we live in this information age, so to say. But we don't really yet, as physicists, as kind of mathematicians and scientists, have a super strong grasp of what it means to be constantly processing information in terms of energetics. Obviously, we know that I have to plug in my computer to the wall in order for it to run. But in a deep physical way, you know, what does it mean that we're doing all this information processing? And this doesn't even have to be a physical computer. It can be a biological agent, you know, some kind of abstract information processor. And so this literature comes out and like Dorzinski and Mandel are very interested in this. There's actually a Feynman paper, The Ratchet and Paul, where he designs this sort of ratchet that's changing bits around, and he's looking at the thermodynamic consequences of this. Mandel and Dorzinski design this ratchet that has computable, like exactly computable probabilities, and say, okay, given some information processor and given a very, very, very abstract idea of like a Turing-like machine. So you say there's some tape that's coming in, has bits in it, and some information processor is reading the tape and then interacting with it. So maybe it reads a bit and decides it's going to flip it, something like that, and then spits out the tape on the other end. So you have two different, you have an information in, information out, and you've got an abstract information processor. What's the thermodynamic consequence of that setup? And then what I was doing was, you know, this had been explored here and there. And then one of my colleagues, Alec Boyd, showed that, in fact, if you're thinking about information in and information out, you can't just think about immediately the consequence of each individual bit flip. Like, you know, at the time that the information processor is interacting with the tape, you can look at what that costs. But what he showed is you also have to consider all of the infinite correlations. So all of the correlations that were happening before your bit flip and all of the correlations that are stretching out into the future. And my work was to actually make that calculable, because that's a pretty intractable problem. Or, you know, just abstract if you're talking about any kind of tape, any kind of information processor. So we lowered the scope a little bit. We narrowed it to just Markov processes, well, hidden Markov processes. And we can talk about what those are, but that made it more tractable mathematically. And so we were able to exactly solve a few cases. And then hopefully, you know, we can make that like physically realizable if we're talking about, again, some kind of biological system someday. But this was just to make it actually calculable for some kind of system.
Okay, so this particular work is looking at how to calculate the thermodynamic functionality of an information processor, and what actually happens. What is it? There's more entropy loss, I guess, than in the more classical calculations. Is that the normal way I put it, or is there something else in there?
Well, so let me maybe define what the different information functionings that we're interested in are, and then I can talk about what my method does differently. So when we say information functionality of a ratchet, so if you go back to this idea of just an engine, just any engine, right? You run a Carnot engine, you're transferring, you know, there's heat, and then you get out work. You can run it in reverse and get a refrigerator where, you know, you actually are making one area colder and it requires work, right? Or you could build a very bad engine that you're doing work on, but it's failing to do this heat transfer, right? So we would call that like a mistake, a dud. We're doing exactly analogous here, but we're adding not just the thermal reservoir, we also have an information reservoir. So this tape that I referred to, that's your information reservoir. So if you take a tape like that and you increase the randomness of the tape, so I had something very ordered. Maybe it was one, two, or sorry, let's do zeros and ones. We'll do bits, right? It was 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. That's an extremely ordered tape. You can predict it very easily. And then I run it through an information processor and the result is completely random. I'm not able to predict whether it's going to be a 0 or 1. I've increased the entropy of the tape. And by doing so, the information processor is actually able to extract useful work. So this is like an engine, right? I've increased entropy and I've got work out. The other like refrigerator side of that is the erasure. So let's say I take a random tape in and I want all zeros out so that it's a totally predictable tape on the other side. In that case, I've had to do work in order to order the tape more. And so this is like a refrigerator. And then the bad case, or the case that we would call a dud, is basically I take the tape and I make it more random, but I do work in order to do that. So in that case, it's like I'm wasting my energy in order to make a tape more random. So I'm just dissipating heat and not getting anything for it. So those are the three like types of functionality that we're interested in. And the question is, you know, how do you actually calculate whether your information engine is acting as an engine or not? And what we look at in order to calculate the amount of work that's being done is the change in the entropy of the tape. And so you have to calculate that by looking at, you know, these big long symbols. And so what normally people do, because calculating the Shannon entropy of an infinitely long tape is practically intractable, is they just truncate it to a single symbol. And so they say, okay, I'm going to estimate what the change in the entropy is just for one bit at a time. But the problem with that is that if you're only considering one bit at a time, you're not considering the fact that these long tapes could have correlations along them. So let's say like two bits, five time steps apart are actually related in some nonlinear way. Well, you have to take into account that that correlation is there in order to correctly identify what the information engine is doing. And so what my method was actually taking some mathematical results that I had developed during my PhD, which allows for the exact calculation of the Shannon entropy in cases where you do have infinitely long correlations. And we were able to do that for processes that are hidden Markov models or are able to be generated by hidden Markov models. So that's a fairly wide class of processes, although it does require that you have like a discrete alphabet and, you know, certain other technical limitations, mathematical technical limitations.
Okay, so what I'd like to look at this point is, you said you want to talk about the Landauer limit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a little bit about entropy, and we just talked a little bit about the information processing thing. So I think this is probably a good idea to talk about whatever you wanted to talk about in terms of Landauer limit and the information processing first law. Maybe I should ask you about that first. What is the information?
Actually, it was a typo in my email. The one that I'm talking about is the information processing second law.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. My bad.
Okay.
There is an information processing first law, but it's actually not my paper is the one that's talking about it.
The first thing that I need to ask about that is, what are the information processing laws?
Because
sure. So, I have no idea.
Okay, well, so, I mean, if we talk about the second law, the second law, as we learn it in general physics, is that entropy must increase, right? So if you do any kind of physical interaction, any kind of process, it has to have overall, if you've done all of your counting correctly, an increase in entropy. What we've realized semi-recently is that that's only true on average. So of course we can have fluctuations that lower entropy. But the overall average action of any physical system must be to increase entropy. And so this caused, and I'll talk about Maxwell's daemon here. So the existence of the second law was actually what caused the confusion for Maxwell's daemon. So Maxwell's daemon is this thought experiment, James Clerk Maxwell, 1867. And he says, what if we had some nimble, what did he call it? Like a nimble fingered being that was able to sit at a partition of a gas chamber and separate out the fast moving molecules from the slow moving molecules. And if you did this, you would actually lower the entropy of the system because you're taking a fully mixed gas from, you know, all of the molecules being in the same bin to something that's been sorted. And so he was just trying to invent some way that you could break the second law. People were very confused by this. It's been, you know, a point of consternation for a long time for physicists because we have this very strong feeling that there should not be any kind of even thought experiment that would allow you to lower entropy. And what happened was, you know, Shannon introduced the idea of information entropy in the 40s. I already mentioned that. And then Landauer introduced this idea that computation can require energetic, you know, have energetic consequences. That was in the 60s. And then in the 80s, Bennett kind of connected these dots. So there was this idea that information can be quantified. Information has energetic consequence. This demon is doing information processing. Like, in order to sort fast and slow molecules, the demon has to actually measure and then remember which molecules are fast and slow. And so the demon is actually recording information and erasing it over time, in order to, you know, record new information. And that is an irreversible computation. It takes energy. The demon's doing work. So therefore it's dissipating heat. So therefore it's increasing entropy. And so what's shown is that any information processing over time must on average increase the entropy more so than your information processing decreases the entropy. And what this means is that, you know, you can write that in the form of a second law: change in entropy greater than or less equal to KBT change in information entropy. So this is, you know, your information processing second law.
So the information processing laws are actually relating the thermodynamic entropy and the informational entropy. Okay, so that's interesting. And you're saying this paper is all about the second law.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the first law has been discussed somewhere else.
Yeah, if you're interested in a nice discussion of the first law, I would point you at I can also send an email later, but my colleague Michael Simon has a nice paper out about the information processing first law.
Okay. Yeah, I would be interested. That would be lovely. Okay. Let me think. Now, did that get us to the Landauer limit? Because I think I heard that in there, but I'm not sure if that's
view. The Landauer limit is a necessary component to relating all of these ideas together, because what Landauer was talking about was this idea that information processing requires or has some kind of energetic consequence to it. And so that was sort of the key to understanding how Maxwell's demon could do this information processing and that then require, or that ultimately raise entropy more so than the information sorting itself was lowering entropy. And therefore this whole system, if you take it all together, is in line with what we expect. Like, the global entropy change should still be positive. So we don't have the second law wrong. We just weren't recognizing that information itself is actually a physical quantity when Maxwell kind of put this whole thought experiment together.
Okay. And so with all that, I think we're probably ready to start getting into some of the mechanics, to start talking about the Markov processes or the hidden Markov processes.
Mm-hmm.
That go into that. I think the first thing is just to tell people what a Markov process is.
Sure.
You know, maybe we can talk about it, why it's hidden. And then after that, we can talk about why it's kind of like a machine. That's all right.
Sounds great. So a Markov process is, if you've taken like a stats course, kind of one of a set of very basic processes. So actually, I'm going to back up and say, I'm going to use the term IID a lot. And what that means is identically independently distributed. And what IID means is that if I have some probability distribution, like, you know, red, green, blue, one third, one third, one third, I can just draw from that. And every time I draw, it's only making reference to the distribution, and it doesn't matter what I got in the prior time step. So this is your coin flip, right? There's no temporal correlation for each draw that I'm doing. The Markov process would be one in which it only depends on your one time step back. That's kind of the classic Markov process. So what I got in what my state was my prior state determines what the probability distribution of the next state will be. You could imagine order n Markov, where now, and rather than just one time step ago, it actually depends on two or three or four. And so you have to look further and further into the past in order to have the correct knowledge of what your probability distribution of the next step will be. A hidden Markov process is one where you kind of have this bipartite idea where there's a Markov process underneath, and then there's a filter such that, so I'm, let's say I'm drawing the red, green, and blue balls out of a, out of an urn or something like that. That's a classic stats case. Well, I don't actually get to see whether they're red, green, or blue. I only get to see, you know, the number written on them or something. So there's some secondary observable that is not the actual Markov state itself. There's some function of the Markov state that is the thing I'm actually able to observe. And because that observable does not necessarily have the Markov property, it's a much more difficult type of process to predict. But there is underlying hidden variable that is Markov.
Okay, so now you're saying you're drawing pool balls out of the urn, and it's more difficult to figure out what's happening as far as the colors that are or the stripe and solid, or even the colors, if you're pulling pool balls out rather than just an urn full of blue and red balls.
Yeah, I think. Sorry, let me.
You have to have the information be muted in some way. So somebody's pulling these out of the urn, just giving you the number.
Yeah, I think actually I'll give a different example, and I don't know how you want to cut this all together, but I think this one is actually the best example for understanding a hidden Markov process. So imagine that you have, you're trying to build a weather predictor, and what you want is to predict whether it's raining or what you're able to observe actually is whether it's sunny or rainy. But the actual Markov variable is what season it is. So fall, or let's say, you know, wet season, dry season, we're in the tropics. So wet season and dry season are your Markov variable in the sense that if it's the dry season, the probability that it's going to change into the wet season only depends on the fact that it's in the dry season, you know? And if it's in the wet season, the probability that you're going to switch to the dry season only depends on the fact that it's currently wet. And so that's your actual Markov process, is the changing of the season. But what you're observing, what you are able to see in your little weather balloon, is whether it's currently sunny or currently raining. And there's a relationship, because when it's the wet season, it's far more likely to rain. And when it's the dry season, it's far more likely to be sunny. But it can rain in the summer and it can be sunny in the winter. So you have this relationship between the two variables, but it's not an exact relationship. And you're only able to access the actual daily weather and not the seasonal variable. And so what you might try to be doing, like commonly when people are talking about hidden Markov processes, they're trying to understand how to infer the hidden variable from your observed variable.
Okay. And so that's why the pool ball analogy doesn't work, is because that's a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. So that's what a hidden Markov process is. Now what you do is you start to put something in a... Oh, it's over here. So I've got a whole page of trying to draw out these machines. So you've got these machines, these hidden Markov machines, and these seem to be sets of states that are writing on a tape.
Yeah.
And when I'm looking at this, when I see the states, what I'm seeing are basically not... I think of them as different heads. Right. So if you had if you have your Turing machine, you have a single head basically, and the tape comes in and stuff happens, and that's all. Here you have what seems to be a bunch of states, and for the hidden Markov machine, you only have basically one sort of thing that can be on the tape, and I guess in the a little bit later you add another sort of thing, which might make it harder, might make it easier. I don't know yet. And so as you're going around and you're reading things with the head and making a change to the tape, sometimes the head switches. So you have these transition matrices that say, okay, every once in a while my state of the head switches to another head, which does different things to the tape. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I think so. This is pretty much the correct way to talk about it. I think, and I apologize, there's so much background in this paper, but there's actually two computing architectures that are relevant. So the first is just this output only machine. And so that's a hidden Markov, a thing that generates a hidden Markov process. So what you have are, let's say, three states, A, B, and C. And those are like your seasons that I was talking about earlier, wet, dry, and let's say an interstitial state, interstitial season. And so those three are the hidden Markov variable, and you're moving in between those, and the observed thing is your zeros and ones. So if I had like three states, just like a little machine sitting on my table, and I let it just run, it's spitting out zeros and ones. And so you can literally just imagine like a tape coming out of a, you know, of a telegraph machine, right? And it's got zeros and ones on it. And so that is a hidden Markov machine that can just generate this tape. But what we're thinking about in this paper is not just something that's generating a tape, but something that's actually interacting with the tape. So that is what, you know, we variously call it, and this is why it can get confusing because there's a lot of different terms in the literature, but input-output machine might be the most kind of descriptive. So it's reading a tape, interacting with it, and then spitting out a new, possibly adjusted tape. We also sometimes call them transducers because we're transducing one information, like one process, to a new process. And the idea there is that they still have states. We still have like the seasonal idea where when the tape comes in, this is, I think, what you mean by like head. The tape comes in, and if it's in state A, the way that the machine or the way that the transducer interacts with the tape depends on the fact that it's in state A. But then once it interacts with the tape, it can move to a new state. So let's say, you know, the transducer's sitting there, it's in state A. The tape comes in, the tape has a one written on it at that time step. According to the rules in state A, seeing a one allows for, you know, flipping the bit and moving to state B, or allows for not flipping the bit and staying where the machine is. So those are the two options. We flip the probability, you know, we decide which one is going to happen. In this time step, the bit gets flipped and the machine updates to state A. Okay. The tape ticks forward. And then you're in state B. So now when the next bit on the tape arrives, the transducer's in state B and it has a new rule book that it's going to consult. And so every time a new bit arrives at the tape, there may be slightly different rules, but there's a finite number of those rule books that exist. And so in our paper, we generally stick to three states because it's easiest to visualize three different states. But you could have N many, right?
Okay. Yeah. So what I was actually thinking of was the head as the state the analogy I had was literally a cassette tape. So I know I'm an old person, and so I know these things.
I think I remember cassette tapes.
Okay. And, you know, even I'm so old, I remember when they were used as magnetic recording devices, right? So like the Commodore VIC 20, you could go and buy a music cassette from, you know, the hardware store, from Walgreens or something like that, click it in and save a program on it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm getting there. But so I think that's pretty much what you're talking about. The head is the thing that's doing the reading and the writing.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the state. And the, but what's happening here, the difference is as this comes in, the head is not just making a decision on whether or not to write onto the tape at this time, or which way to write at this time, or whatever, however you want to characterize it. As long as it's zero or one, not too much of a difference. It's also making a decision whether to switch to another state. And one of the things I was confused about in the paper was, how does it decide that? Does it go through many iterations? Does it just, when it reads the information? Does it make that decision? And so apparently it does make that decision as it reads, makes a decision on what to do. And that includes both the writing and the flip.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
So in the way that we've set it up, yeah, this all happens in like a finite interval. We decide that this interaction is happening for tau length of time. So we actually set that as a parameter. And that is happening all kind of in this interval. It reads, makes the decision on what it's going to do, and then writes, and then transition after the interval is over.
Okay. So this kind of gets me into the two reservoirs, I guess. So you have a heat reservoir, and you have a work, I guess maybe not a reservoir, but you have heat and work. Heat, usually thinking about a reservoir. They're going to pull heat in or push heat out. And I guess the way I'd been thinking about it was that the heat reservoir was doing the flipping, but that's not the case here. This is, so they're actually doing something very different in this case.
Right. So what we think about here is, you know, when you imagine a classic engine, you have two thermal reservoirs necessarily at different temperatures in order to have, you know, a thermodynamic, you know, cycle going on, and then a work reservoir, which we kind of, you can usually, we think about some mass attached to this thing that's being raised or lowered. So it's doing some kind of work. In this case, we swapped out one of our thermal reservoirs with a informational reservoir, which is our tape. And then the engine itself is the stochastic controller. This, you know, you've pictured it as like a head that's coming down and reading your record or whatever. And that is interacting with the information reservoir by reading and writing, and then also interacting with the thermal reservoir by potentially dissipating heat, or interacting with the work reservoir by potentially, you know, raising or lowering a mass or doing whatever useful work we might imagine we want this object to do.
I guess this would not be part of this, I suspect. Okay. That the powering of the flip in the states, that's not necessarily coming from the work reservoir or the heat reservoir, is it? Or yes?
Well,
or no?
So we usually, the way that we've set this up, or the way that Mandel and Jarzynski set this up, is that they put some energetic cost on, or energetic cost or benefit on a bit flip. So what they say is that, you know, maybe 0 to 1, if you do that, you get back some amount of energy. If you flip from 1 to 0, it costs some amount of energy. And you know, you can decide how physically that would be realized. Maybe, you know, literally you're flipping, electrons that have some energetic preference for one or the other, something like that. Right. But when we just think about this abstractly, like there's some energetic benefit to going one way versus the other. And so if you are going in the direction, if you're flipping every single bit in the direction that costs energy, you would be pulling out of, you know, you'd have to be doing work, pulling that out of the work reservoir. Whereas if you're, you know, caught flipping every single bit in the direction that is energetically favorable, you're actually able to do work in that case. But that's kind of the classic setup. What we often do now is we actually just directly relate the probability of these actions. So the probability of going from, let's say I'm in state A and I read a bit that's 0, and I say, okay, I just want the probability of a bit flip and a move to state C. So A0 to, let's say, C1, I want that to be 1/3 probability. And from the fact that it's a third, like probability of a third that you could do that, you calculate what the energetic cost or benefit of that transition would have to be. And that is determined because these are autonomous ratchets that we're not driving them with any kind of internal thing. So if you were driving it, you could force it to flip a bit and move to state C by inputting energy into the system. But in this case, it's autonomous. So the probability that it does any particular path is determined by the energetics of that path. If that kind of make sense why that would be the case.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. So basically, I guess what you're saying is this bit comes in. And when the new bit comes in, that changes the energetics of what it looks like for the head. And the head has these transition probabilities that say, that basically say, I can do this, that, or the other thing. And if this is basically set it to a place that I guess has greater energy, then, you know, that's what it does, is the head gains energy when it does that transition.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that seems reasonably good to me. And you said you wanted to talk about the entropy rate with these processes. Is this a good point to talk about that, or is this a little early?
No, sure. Let's talk about entropy rate. So I suppose we should first define entropy rate. So when we talked about entropy, I was talking about like Shannon's information entropy. And the way that when we read that to Gibbs entropy, we're generally talking about single shot entropy. So let's say I have five possibilities, 1 through 5, or let's do a dice, actually. Let's just 1 through 6, because you just roll a dice. Each are equally probable. And so in that case, you take each possible event, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you say each of those have a probability associated with them. And I sum up P log P. So it'd be 1/6 log 1/6 times 6, right? Because they're all the same. So that would just come out to log of 1/6. And that's the Shannon entropy of that particular die roll. And you could imagine that if you're at a more shady casino, your dice is loaded in some way. And so maybe evens are more probable. And then you'd have an not completely flat distribution. Your Shannon entropy would actually, go up in go down in this case, because the Shannon entropy is maximized by the most flat probability distribution. And we think about that as the higher the Shannon entropy, the more unpredictable the result is. So if your dice is totally fair, you're maximally unable to predict what the result will be. Whereas if it's a loaded die and a one is highly probable result, you are pretty well able to predict that you're going to get a one. And so in that case, the Shannon entropy is quite low. And so when you think about an entropy rate, what you're thinking about is a repeated dice roll. And so when I defined IID up at the very beginning, that was a type of process where it is a dice roll. So every single one is exactly the same in terms of its entropic informational content. But let's imagine instead I'm taking the temperature every day. And the temperature has some complicated long-range correlations because, it depends on season, it depends on the position of the sun, there's all this complicated stuff. So knowledge of my past helps me predict my future. And in that case, I can actually think about the entropy rate, which is the marginal, like my marginal difficulty in predicting the next outcome given knowledge of my infinite past. And that's what we call the Shannon entropy rate.
Okay. And so that requires knowledge of the infinite past.
Yeah. In kind of mathematical formalism, you actually have to know the infinite past, but not always, right? So with temperature, probably so, like on planet Earth, at least. But if you had something that had a, kind of decayed memory, right? It only impacts the future for 6 time steps into the future. In that case, you wouldn't need to know the infinite past. You would only need to know up to 6 time steps ago. And so remember when I talked about like order 6 Markov, that would be where, the entropy rate stops, like I stop gaining predictive power looking further back in the future or further back in the past, because only 6 time steps is what's actually going to benefit me. But in general, you have to think about infinite correlations. And that was why it was so difficult to calculate this prior to the work that I was doing in my PhD.
Is this the work that you were doing in your PhD, or were you a postdoc for this?
So I was still a PhD student when I did this, but I kind of, most of like my thesis was focused on solving this exact problem of how does one calculate the entropy rate for HMMs, hidden Markov models that can have this infinite correlation length. And then this paper kind of came out of applying that method to a case where it was needed, because people were looking at these thermodynamic machines and they were having these infinite correlations, but not sure how to handle calculating them. So the work I was doing with my PhD kind of allowed us to tackle this extant problem with that new methodology. But I was still a PhD student. I just sort of referred to the mathematical part of it as what I did during my PhD, because I think of that as like the main thrust of my thesis.
Oh, okay. So your dissertation was on one thing, and this is the application that's related to, you know, one of the other people in your lab, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't really a lab, but maybe it was.
We still call ourselves a lab. We didn't have any benches or anything, but yeah. That's absolutely the correct case. So basically I was over here working on this like mathematical method, and my colleagues who were at the same lab as me were kind of working on this thermodynamic problem. And our shared mentor, Jim, was sort of like, well, you know, we've got a nice convergence here, so let's apply this mathematical method to this thermodynamic problem. And yeah, that's how it ended up.
Yeah, when I was looking through the references, there was a big web of stuff.
our lab
was fairly difficult to try to suss out what was, you know, who to contact.
Right. We have a lot of students. There was a lot of students in Jim's lab when I was there, and we all sort of we were all doing our own thing. But of course, being there in the same physical space, you're interacting with each other. And I don't know if you looked at my other work, but I also have a paper that's on kind of quantum information processing. And it's very much the same story, where we were interested in where we wanted to apply this particular mathematical method, and some other people in our lab were doing quantum information, and we were like, oh, there's a spot there where we can kind of do this application. So that's why it ended up being so eclectic in my thesis.
Okay, well, excellent. If what you're doing gives you an application right away, that's pretty nice, right?
Yeah, we were excited about it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, so we've got an idea about what the entropy rate is, and what I did want to talk about the informational structure, partially because at the end you have a really nice, I don't know if you want to call it a phase diagram. It's not really a phase diagram, but you have a really nice diagram about different sort of situations you can get into, which we'll talk about at the end. But you said that this would be a good place to talk about that, and I would like to know what informational structure really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I can talk about this for ages, because this is really my bread and butter. So what I think is so interesting about like this kind of idea of why are physicists studying information at all, right? You know, information is kind of a CS, computer science idea. But I think that there's so much there for physicists to think about in terms of, we see structure everywhere in the natural world, and this can be quantified, or we're trying to get to a place where we can quantify this. So when we think about like information in physics, and we think about trying to determine or study, like think about what we're trying to study when we talk about information, what I often picture is an axis of what you can call this a phase space of two orthogonal ideas. And the lower axis is the most familiar to most people, and that's the Shannon entropy axis. And that is just pure randomness. So how predictable is a process? And if you had something like a sinusoid, it's completely predictable, right? I mean, given my prior, you know, history, I can completely predict exactly what's going to happen next. So something like that, very, very low Shannon entropy. And we can think about a highly random process, like a random coin, and you say, okay, that's a lot of Shannon entropy because it's really hard to predict. But it's not very interesting in this type, in the way that we want physical systems to be interesting, because it's just pure chance. It's just a coin being flipped over and over. There's not anything really deeper to understand about something like that. But you can imagine something that's in between, right? Something that has some amount of randomness to it, has some difficulty in predicting it, but is also not purely ordered. And that's kind of going back to this temperature that I was talking about earlier. It's actually quite difficult to predict exactly what the temperature is going to be, on a Shannon entropy kind of level. But we recognize that if you were to measure the temperature over the last 50 years, there's this very clear structural pattern that emerges. It has to do with, you know, the entire structure of the solar system, the distance from the sun, the tilt of the Earth. And so by taking into account these very long-range correlations, you actually observe this memory structure. And so the way that we measure something like that is we ask ourselves, what type of predictive architecture would be able to capture this pattern? And so if I have something that is periodic, like 5 period, I need 5 memory states in order to capture that. Okay, so then I say the structural component, the structural informational content in this, you know, process is a 5-period machine. But you could have something that is particularly difficult, like weather, to calculate, where I'm going to need some kind of predictive machine that takes into account how far we are from the sun, what the tilt of the Earth is, like all of these things. And keeping track of all those memory states might be extraordinarily expensive. So this kind of relates to concepts like Kolmogorov complexity, which asks, what is the minimal model that I can write down that will predict the system, you know, the system's next state? And so the question is, what is the minimal, most optimally predictive model? And then the structure of that determines how informationally structured my process is. And the way that we build a model like that, we use this idea of computational mechanics, which is how do I, or the states of my machine should be those that are predictively equivalent to each other. So if I have, you know, again, temperature, and I say the temperature is the same every time these 5 indicators are the same. And maybe those 5 indicators are, you know, soil moisture, atmospheric carbon content, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, you know, I only have to keep track of those 5 things in order to predict the temperature. But those 5 things can vary in a multitude of different ways. And so in order to characterize a structure, I have to characterize all of the possible quantities that those 5 things can take on. And that ends up being like the secondary structural informational content that that creates this phase diagram, this orthogonal, not just randomness, but also memory, also pattern over time, also, you know, structure of large scale physical systems. And being able to do both of those things at once, or characterize both of those things at once, is what we kind of, you know, try to call complexity. Complexity is a pretty fraught term. But if we had a system that's kind of hard to predict, but not impossible, has a lot of memory, we would call that system complex.
Okay, now these diagrams we're talking about, these diagrams reminded me of ternary phase diagrams, where we have a mixture of 3 different metals, and the points of the triangles each represents a complete 100% composition of one of those metals, and the point inside represents, you know, 10% of this, 30% of this, 60% of that.
Basically, you know, these were the states, the heads.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, the probability that you'd be on each one of those particular heads. And then you were plotting that, I guess, as you ran the machine. And some of these ended up looking like fractals, right?
Yes.
And simultaneously, you're talking sort of about their dimension as one of these parameters that you thought was very important. I guess you're using the fractal dimension. It's not the Hausdorff dimension, or is it the Hausdorff?
Not. So we're actually looking at the Minkowski dimension, mm-hmm. which is also sometimes called the box counting dimension, which is, you know, equivalent to the Hausdorff dimension, but sometimes, but not always. So these fractals, where they come from. So, okay. So you have this idea of, given any kind of process, given any kind of physical system where I'm taking measurement over time, I can have two axes that I'm interested in. One is the randomness, which is just the predictability, and one is this, you know, complexity in terms of its memory structure. How do I figure out what that memory structure is? So what is the optimal set of states that are required in order to predict that process? That's the question that needs to be answered in order to understand what the informational structure is. So the simplex that you're talking about, it's a machine that has states A, B, and C, and it's doing that thing that we talked about earlier, which is that it's spitting out ones and zeros. Those A, B, C states might not be the optimal states that I need in order to optimally predict the process. So let's go back to the weather example, the temperature, dry or wet season example. So it could be the case that, you know, wet and dry season gives me this prediction ability for whether or not it's going to be sunny or rainy, or it determines the probability of whether it's going to be sunny or rainy. But maybe it turns out that rather than just knowing the season, actually keeping in my memory bank the last 2 months of rainy or wet, or rainy or sunny, actually is a better indicator than just knowing the season. And in that case, what I would do is I would draw a line between, you know, what the probability is that I think I'm in the wet season, or what the probability is that I think I'm in the dry season. And I would record on that line what my probability is at any given time step. And then that line fills up with marks as I'm getting more and more, you know, I've observed 10,000 days, and the probability that I'm in the wet season versus the dry season is now, I don't know, 43 and 57 or something like that. And I record that on my little diagram. And then as those marks start to fill up, what we see is that they actually have this fractal structure when the process itself has infinite memory length. So if it's the case that this system has very, very, very long time correlations, keeping track of all of my history gives me a new distribution over what state I think I'm in every single time step. And those things look fractal. And then what's a good way to measure the complexity of a thing that looks fractal? Well, the dimension, right? So I'm filling out this space between the wet season and the dry season with little marks. It's not filling out 100%, so it's not a line. And it's not just one mark or just three marks. It's an infinite number. I keep adding new lines every single time I take a new measurement. And so what I find is that, oh, actually, if I look over my history and I kind of take an average over a very, very long measurement, the amount of that line that I'm filling out is, you know, the Cantor set or something like that. And that measurement gives me the complexity value of my process, or it's one measure of the complexity value, I should say. And the measure is the statistical complexity dimension, because it is an actual dimension.
So you have that complexity dimension.
I'm worried that was a bit hard to follow.
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, that was exactly the sort of thing that I wanted to hear about. That is, you know, why are we using this dimension, and what does it mean in some sense? Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the only thing we might remind people is the way you're doing this in time steps. I don't know. I think you said the mixed states were uncountable, but we're not talking about the mixed states, are we?
We are talking about the mixed states.
Okay. Yeah. So you're saying there are an uncountable number of mixed states, but you still are getting the fractal structure.
Well, so in order for it to be a fractal, there have to be an uncountable number. So I keep going back to this example. I hope it's a useful one, but this seasonal example. So let's imagine that, you know, you don't know what season you're in. It could be wet, could be dry, and you're estimating the probability of each by watching the weather, right? The daily rain or sun. And let's say that you keep doing this and it turns out that you're only ever getting like two answers. So you're either one third possibility of wet, two thirds possibility of dry, or other way around, one third possibility of dry, two thirds possibility of wet. Like you're ping ponging between those two, right? In that case, when you're drawing like your marks on your paper, you're only having two dots, and that's a countable set, right? It's two. And so the dimension of something like that is zero because it's just two dots. And so it's not a line. It's a finite set. And so in that case, your statistical complexity dimension is just zero. And I'm actually able to predict my process within a finite memory length because I only need to keep in mind these two possibilities. If instead it turns out that I keep having a new possibility, I keep updating my probability that I'm in the wet season or the dry season, and I keep drawing new lines, and I'm never actually able to consolidate down on a finite number of possibilities, that's when it's like a fractal, because the characterization of a fractal is an object, a mathematical object, where no matter how much you zoom in, there's always structure in between. Like even if you zoom in and you only look at the possibilities in a very, very small part of that simplex, a very, very small part of the line, there's still the structure. And in fact, because it's a fractal, the structure that you see on that very zoomed in part will mirror the structure that you see on the larger scale. And so that property, that uncountable number of possible states, is actually necessary for there to be a non-zero statistical complexity dimension. And that indicates the presence of infinite correlations.
Okay, and the box counting dimension is, as you change the size of the box, how many boxes do you need to cover the entire set? And in this case, what you end up with is you end up with some fractional part, yeah, some fractional dimension as you zoom in. So this is very interesting. Yeah, I forgot. The fractal isn't the thing you see. The fractal is the limit of the things you see as you keep removing things, say, from your Cantor middle third set.
Yeah, right. So the Cantor set is kind of your classic fractal where you start out with a line and then you take out the middle third, and then you have two lines, and then you take out the middle thirds of those, and then you have four lines, and you keep doing that. And eventually you get down to this, you can't actually even see it if you try to draw this, but you get down to this set that's still infinite. But it is, not a line, but not a single dot. And so it has this actually log 2/3, is the dimension of that object. And so what we get is things that are like that. They're usually more irregular. They're not perfect fractals because, there's some kind of weird structural component that comes from some infinite correlation length. But they're similar to that type of object mathematically. And then, yeah, we calculate this kind of box covering dimension, which would be, the number of boxes that will cover your object. You keep shrinking the size of the box. The number of the boxes required goes up as you shrink the size of them. And you look at the line that's created by the, plotting how many boxes against how big are the boxes. And that creates a line. The slope of that is your box counting dimension.
And I guess one of the weird things here that, you just mentioned is that when you have all these dots, if you were to count up all the dots, you can't because they're uncountable, right? Mm-hmm. There would be more of them than, say, the natural numbers. That's what you mean by uncountable. Mm-hmm. But it would be just as much as it's the same measure as the length of that line segment that you're doing it. So it's one of these weird paradoxes in infinity that makes everybody happy.
Okay. Yeah, I was kind of the object of, not mockery, much, much kinder than that. But people in my lab were sort of like, what are you doing? Because I was, I'm trained as a physicist, right? So I'm not really a mathematician, although I do all this mathematics. And I was getting into like this, fractal dimension theory stuff that it is weird. It's kind of makes your head hurt because, as you say, it's still measure one. These fractal attractors are still measure one, but they are weird fractional dimensions and weird infinite sets. And, you know, you actually have to get into like a little bit of topology to really make sense of it. So it was a lot of fun, actually. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good, good. I mean, I always love Infinity. Infinity is fun. Okay. Let's see. So, do you think we've talked enough about your, I mean, we do have to get into your main result. So do you think we've talked enough about that? Or what did you want to talk about with that?
Well, why don't I talk about, like just for a moment, how we actually calculate the statistical complexity dimension?
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. And actually, I don't know, I don't want to make work for you, but I'd like to just sort of amend maybe something I said earlier, which was I was talking about these optimally predictive machines, and I didn't actually name what they're called. So we call these epsilon machines because they come from this idea that you build an epsilon equivalence class of equivalently predictive histories. So you say, I measure all of the histories of my possible process, and those. So if I only have two distinctively predictive hit pasts, you would only have two states. And so that would be a finite state epsilon machine. The ones that we work with, they have this uncountable number of histories because actually every single possible history of my process gives me a new prediction. And sort of what we were pointing out is that if that's the case, if you say, oh, every different history gives you a new prediction, you might just say, well, throw up your hands. Every single past is a new prediction. There's no point in building a model at all. Like, you might as well just remember your infinite past. But what we show here is that actually, if you put those infinite pasts on a geometric plane, like the simplex, you can show that even though there's an infinite number of them, some are more similar than others. Right. And so they have this geometric structure that we capture using the fractal dimension. So the fractal dimension, the reason that we're interested in the statistical complexity dimension is because the lower it is, the more finitized the state set looks. So if I have a statistical complexity dimension that's very close to zero, what that tells me is that even though the process requires in theory requires an infinite number of histories in order to optimally predict, in practice, it's really close to being finite because I've got something that looks really, really close to being just sort of four dots, right? And that is actually measured by the statistical complexity dimension. So I'm not sure I actually said why we care about that. And that's why. And then to calculate it, you can do an estimation because you can do this box counting thing and you can literally just draw boxes and count them and then draw boxes smaller and then count them again. But this is, I wasn't really pleased with that when I was working on my thesis because those numerical methods can be somewhat unstable. And so what we ended up doing, kind of actually the main result, was we showed that the generation of these sets can be identified as the attractor of a dynamical system. So the dynamical system is generating trajectories that trace out this fractal attractor. And then once you have that dynamical system, you can actually use what's known as the Kaplan-York conjecture, which relates the dynamics of the system to its fractal or its information dimension. And so we studied the dynamics of the system that generates these sets of states and showed that you can actually calculate the Lyapunov exponents and calculate and then compute the statistical complexity dimension. And that required kind of a rewriting of the Kaplan-York conjecture into our own conjecture. And then we had to show that that works for kind of this restricted class of models. So that was actually the main result that drove this whole application to the thermodynamic sphere and was very, very mathematical. So we don't have to get into the whole dynamical system stuff, but that was actually why we did all this to begin with.
So this gets you into why you did this, but I know we haven't really talked too much about putting the entropy rate and the fractal dimension together, right?
Sure.
which is, I mean, this beautiful diagram, figure seven, that is really interesting. Now, I guess probably before that, we ought to talk about the different situations you looked at, because this looks at just one of them. It looks like this just looks at, so you had three different sort of situations you looked at. You looked at a biased coin, a period two, and a golden mean, and these are the input tapes, right? So the biased coin is flipping a coin that sometime, or more often than not, right, lands heads, let's say. Period two is heads, tails, or 0101. And you've talked a lot about that particular situation already. And then you had this golden mean engine, which is, why don't I just ask you, why did you look at the golden mean engine? Because, I mean, the other ones, it's very obvious why. What is it and why was it interesting?
Yeah, so the golden mean we just looked at because it was cool. And we, so if you look at, if you look at the space of binary processes, by which I mean those that, you know, are zeros and ones, that have only two states, there's not that many. So the golden mean is one of those. So to define what the golden mean is, you imagine that you have two states, A and B, and in one state, there's the possibility of seeing either a zero or a one. And that probability of seeing either a zero or a one is characterized by a S one minus S probability, or P, or one minus P, you know. And then if you see a zero, you transition to the secondary state, which always just emits a one and transitions back. So if you can kind of visualize that, what that ends up being for your probability distributions over words is that you can only ever have one zero. And I apologize that we're using ones and zeros and also counting them up. But you can only have a solitary zero, let's say, interspersed with however many ones. So it could be a solitary one, or it could be a one of infinite length. And the reason it's called a golden mean is because if you look at the averages over time, you get to the golden mean.
Okay. But the tape that you were, or the tape that you got this particular figure out of, was the biased coin. Is that correct?
When you say figure seven. You mean figure six? Oh, no.
I was looking at figure seven. Figure six is the phase diagram. Okay, yes, so you wanted to talk about the phase diagram. That's okay. So for the phase diagram, was which one was that for? That was the golden mean.
Yeah. So
and that one went back to some previous work of someone else, one of your coworker or your lab mates, I guess, where he showed something interesting. And did you just break his heart? Is that what happened?
Well, okay. So what the result from figure six is like I mentioned. So the main thing that we were trying to do here was incorporate the infinite length correlations, which my work with this, like, you know, recharacterizing HMMs as the attractors of dynamical systems, that allows you then to calculate the entropy rate for HMMs that even have infinite states. And that allowed us to calculate the entropy rate difference for these information engines, because way back, you know, 90 minutes ago, what we were saying was, oh, the work that we're able to do with these information engines that have input and output tapes is related to the difference in the entropy rate of the input and output tapes. So, you know, you insert a tape, it has some entropy rate, the information processor does something to it, and then the output tape has some new entropy rate, which could be higher or it could be lower. And if the entropy rate is higher, it generally means that the information engine is extracting energy and doing work. And if the information, the entropy is now lower, it usually means that the information processor is acting as an eraser. It's erasing out like randomness from the tape. And so what we showed was that if you don't take into account these infinite correlations, you can actually mischaracterize this behavior. So we showed that this was the most egregious with the golden mean, because the golden mean has a lot of infinite length correlations when you input it into this information processor. So if you don't take that into account, you can actually mischaracterize what the information processor is doing. And in fact, you can sometimes imply that it is breaking the second law, depending on kind of where you where you parameterize your machine. And so we were just really emphasizing there the importance of taking into account these long range correlations if you want to understand the thermodynamic consequence of doing information processing.
Okay. So there is this little sliver region that's violating the second law. Actually, it looks reasonably good because you get rid of a lot of, I'm looking at a black and white copy, but it looks like you get rid of a lot of this sort of, well, no, when you get rid of that eraser area, you just get a dud.
Which is yeah, it's kind worse. Of a bummer, actually.
Yeah. But you get rid of that little sliver. So previous work had already implied that that was a problem, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we were sort of responding to Mandel and Jarzynski's paper where they had done this single shot entropy, but they were well aware that you do need to have these infinite length correlations. So I don't think we were breaking any hearts by pointing it out, but we were really excited to be able to actually calculate it and show that given some input, it really does matter. For the case that Mandel and Jarzynski looked at in their paper, which was a memoryless input, I talk about that in the appendix, it really doesn't matter because they were kind of intrinsically choosing inputs that didn't have a lot of correlation, and the ratchet they designed didn't induce a lot of correlation. So if you have no correlation on either side, well, calculating the correlations, it doesn't make a big difference. But we were really interested in the case where you do have correlation. So that was, I guess that's why we chose the golden mean, if you want a more like coherent answer to that question, because it's a highly correlated machine. And so it really mattered to make sure and calculate that out.
Okay, and that's a great result. So is there anything else you want to talk about before we sort of wind down?
Oh, well, did you want to talk about figure 7?
I would like to talk about figure 7. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I can explain figure 7.
Okay.
And hopefully like the listeners are able to reference it here. I can explain it kind of quickly. So this is where the paper actually sort of goes into part 2. So the first half of the paper, all up until this point, we were only looking at the difference in this entropy rate. And then what I was interested in this part 2 was, you know, I rambled about the idea of this or two orthogonal axes, like both randomness and structure matter. But everything that we had done with the information engines, we were only comparing differences in randomness, which is our Shannon entropy rate. So we were asking ourselves, well, maybe structure also has a thermodynamic consequence that would make sense to us. So we wanted to look at not just changes in the Shannon entropy rate, but also changes in the statistical complexity dimension. And that's how you get this 4 quadrants. You can either increase or decrease your Shannon entropy rate, and you can increase or decrease your statistical complexity dimension. And we designed machines that did each of those, like all possibilities of increasing and decreasing, which is what this figure is showing. And what we showed is that while there is a strong relationship in the sense that, you know, there are clear patterns to whether or not a information engine is constructing or deconstructing structure, it doesn't seem to constrain the thermodynamic processing. So we were able to construct information engines that acted as engines. We were able to construct information erasers that properly erased, whether they were constructing or deconstructing. So it was kind of an interesting result. And we're still really curious about this because, you know, there definitely should be thermodynamic consequence to whether or not you are, you know, requiring more memory for your output. But we're just not quite sure what the actual functional relationship is. So it's an open question for us.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's really striking, of course, because you have some places here. We've got in one place you just end up with a point, and in one case it looks like you end up with a line, and then you end up with two different structures that are probably fractal. One I think you show, and then the other one looks like it's probably a fractal, but it's a bunch of dots in a straight line. But I mean, it's still probably.
It's a fractal. It's just okay. just a fractal that's less than one dimension. So like your character set,
That's incredibly interesting. I'm really glad we got to talk about this information structure, mostly because it wasn't something I really got out of this paper, but it's incredibly interesting in itself. It was actually might be a little more interesting than the paper.
Well, I mean, you know, not to just monopolize your time, and I certainly don't have time today, but I would be super thrilled to just talk about that result itself, because that's actually, I mean, the thermodynamic stuff I find really fascinating, and I do have like other thermodynamic work I'm interested in, but I would say my bread and butter is this informational structure stuff. Like that's what we're kind of doing at INRIA, and that's what I find very fascinating, is intrinsically the geometry of these processes.
It's been kind of long, and I did want to talk about alternative approaches, but I think probably we can skip that. Thank you very much for coming on, and I think this is a great podcast, and I think everybody will like listening to this. You were very engaging.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 77, Maxwellian Ratchets with Alex Juergens. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/77. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, related episodes of Physics Frontiers, and a smattering of other things. I would like to thank you very much for listening again, and hopefully you'll listen for the next one. The next one, I think, will be on quantum machine learning. We'll see about that then, right? Bye now.